Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Ann Ball and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, members of the ethnic Hmong community in Fresno, California, are in mourning after gunmen shot 10 men, killing 4 over the weekend. Police said at least 2 men, armed with semi-automatic handguns, entered the backyard of a house and started shooting into a crowd. About 16 men had gathered there to watch a football game on television. The gunmen did not speak, and no one had a good look at them. Police said witnesses only saw flashes of gunfire in the dark. Sunday evening's attack killed Si Lee, a popular Hmong singer and musician. His YouTube videos have been viewed millions of times. Also killed were Pia Vang, Ku Jong, and Kalasang Tao. Officials said 6 were wounded, including 3 in serious condition. Women and children inside the house were not hit. Pao Yang is head of the Fresno Center, a Hmong community group. He said, "Our community is in mourning, and we still don't know what's going on or who are the suspects." On Si Lee's YouTube channel, one fan wrote, "We will miss you so, so, so much, Brother Si. Rest well. We will meet again." Another added, "Your songs hit hard this time around. R.I.P., brother." Paula Yang is a friend of the homeowner, whose brother, Ku Jong, died in the attack. She said, "The shooting has many in the community fearful." Yang said, "Even right now, families are gathering inside saying, 'What can we do to protect our home from this day forward?'" The Hmong are an ethnic group from the mountain areas separating Laos and Vietnam. Many fled after fighting alongside the United States during the Vietnam War. The 2017 census estimates about 300,000 Hmong live in the U.S., including 25,000 in Fresno. The Fresno police chief said, "This is truly a good group of people who were simply having a party." However, the police are investigating whether the shooting was connected to a recent disturbance involving some of the people at the party. While they had not found any gang connections to the victims, Fresno police are concerned about the possibility of retaliation or more violence ahead of the Hmong New Year. The celebration comes the week after Christmas and draws thousands of Hmong to Fresno. Police said there have been 11 violent incidents related to Asian gangs in Fresno this year, 3 of them in November. The Fresno shooting was also the 3rd mass shooting in 4 days in California. Last Thursday, a 16-year-old boy killed 2 students and wounded 3 others at his high school in Santa Clarita near Los Angeles before killing himself. On Saturday, a San Diego man shot and killed his wife and 3 of their sons before killing himself. A 4th son was on life support.
from above, Midway Atoll appears out of the blue waters of the Pacific Ocean as a small oasis of land. Its white, sandy beaches look full of life. Yet on the ground, the coastline looks very different. There is plastic, pollution, and death. With almost no predators, Midway Atoll is a safe place for many kinds of seabirds. It is home to the largest colony of albatross in the world. But Midway is also at the center of what researchers call the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a huge area of floating plastic collected by oceanic currents. A recent study found that the area is collecting debris at a faster rate than scientists had thought. Midway is covered with skeletons of birds that have brightly colored plastic sticking out from their stomachs. Bottle tops, toothbrushes, and cigarette lighters sit in the centers of the remains. Sharp plastic pieces can also cut through birds' organs. There isn't a bird that doesn't have some plastic, says Athleen Clark of the United States National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She oversees the Papahanaumokuakea Marine National Monument, the world's largest marine protection area. It protects much of the Hawaiian archipelago, of which Midway is a part. Papahanaumokuakea is both a biologically rich and culturally sacred place, Clark said. The Hawaiians call it a place of abundance. Ocean currents now bring an abundance of plastic and other waste materials from all around the Pacific Rim to the area. The trash includes both small particles of plastic and objects like huge fishing nets. These capture plants, animals, and other debris while moving across weak coral reefs. Clark said scientists estimate about 26,000 kilograms of debris washes up on this part of the island group each year. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Kelly Goodale lives and works on Midway. She says the plastic that washes up there each year is just part of the problem. Not only are our beaches getting it, but also our albatross will bring it and feed it to their chicks, Goodale said. Albatross spend much of their lives at sea feeding. The birds fly thousands of kilometers across the ocean before returning to Midway each year to lay eggs and raise their young. We estimate about 5 tons of plastic being brought to Midway every year just by adult albatross feeding it to their chicks, Goodale said. It is not just seabirds that are harmed by ocean plastic. Endangered Hawaiian monk seals and green sea turtles can die while trapped in plastic netting. Sharks and other predators eat smaller fish that feed on small plastic particles. It is important to understand the relationship between the ocean, marine life, and humans, Clark said. She shared a native Hawaiian expression, Ma o ke kai pili ai kakao. It means the ocean connects us all.
A new report says the number of international students coming to American colleges and universities fell last year for the third straight year. The report from the Institute of International Education found that the number of newly admitted foreign students dropped by 1% in the autumn of 2018 compared to the year before. This follows decreases of 7% and 3% in the 2 years before that. Those were the first drops in attendance in more than 10 years. The decreasing numbers of foreign students is an issue for many schools in the United States that have come to depend on tuition payments from them. Foreigners are usually charged higher amounts than U.S. citizens are. Some schools blame President Donald Trump's comments about immigrants for keeping students away. However, the State Department, which paid for the new report, dismissed the idea.
Caroline Casagrand works in the department's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. She said the high cost to attend U.S. schools frightens students. She also said the decrease is linked to students who were seeking admission to college during the presidency of Barack Obama. She added that the numbers appear to be going back up under Trump. What we've seen today is a dramatically better picture compared to last year's declines, Casagrand said during a telephone call with reporters. She added that the Trump administration has provided more resources than ever to international student mobility. While fewer new international students are coming, the study found that more are staying for specialized training after they finish college. More than 220,000 were given permission to stay for temporary work through a federal program, an increase of about 10% over fall 2017.
China continued to send more students than any other country, followed by India, South Korea, and Saudi Arabia. However, years of growth from China have leveled off. The number of Chinese students in U.S. schools rose by less than 2%. Some colleges and universities have noted major decreases in Chinese students signing up for classes. At the University of Alabama, the number of Chinese students has dropped by 43% over the past 2 years. At the University of Iowa and at Kansas State University, Chinese enrollment fell by about a third in the same period. Education experts have blamed the drop in Chinese students on several things.
Chinese students have reported difficulty getting U.S. visas in the middle of a trade war between the two nations. Universities in Australia and Canada have worked harder to interest Chinese students in their colleges and universities. Also, some educators say concerns over academic espionage or spying have fueled anti-China feelings at U.S. schools. State Department officials said they are working to ease tensions and persuade Chinese students to study in the United States. Casagrand said the department is working hard to make sure that Chinese students know they are welcome here. "We want these Chinese students here," she added. The State Department recently sent a group to China to speak in support of academic exchanges. U.S. Ambassador Terry Branstad recently wrote an opinion piece in a Chinese youth publication inviting students to study in the U.S.
The report also found that far fewer students are coming from Saudi Arabia. This began in 2017 when Saudi officials cut back on a program that provided money to study around the world. There were also drops in students coming from South Korea, Japan, and Mexico. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Abraham Lincoln won the presidential election in November of 1860. When he took office several months later, he faced the most serious crisis in American history. The southern states had finally acted on their earlier threats. They had begun to leave the Union over the issue of slavery. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant talk about this critical time in American history.
The southern states did not want Abraham Lincoln to win the election of 1860. Lincoln was a Republican, and the Republican Party opposed slavery. Lincoln never said he wanted to end slavery in the South. He did not believe anyone had the right to do so. Yet he did not want to see slavery spread to other parts of the United States. Lincoln told Southerners, "You think slavery is right and should be extended, while we think it is wrong and should be limited. That, I suppose, is the trouble. It surely is the only important difference between us."
Pro-slavery extremists felt this difference was enough, and they were sure Lincoln and his Republicans would soon win control of Congress and the Supreme Court. Before long, they thought, the Constitution would be changed. Slavery would become illegal everywhere. Even if this did not happen, Southerners were worried. Unless slavery could spread, they said, the slave population in the South would become too large. In time, blacks and whites would battle for control. One or the other would be destroyed. So, even before the presidential election, Southerners began discussing what they would do if Abraham Lincoln won.
Early in October, the governor of South Carolina, William Gist, wrote letters to the governors of other southern states. He said they should agree on what action to take if Lincoln became president. Gist said South Carolina would call a state convention as soon as the election results were made official. If any state decided to leave the Union, he said, South Carolina would follow. If no other state decided to leave, then South Carolina would secede by itself. Governor Gist received mixed answers. Two states, Alabama and Mississippi, said they would not secede alone, but they said they would join others that made this decision. Two more states, Louisiana and Georgia, said they would not secede unless the North acted against them. And one state, North Carolina, said it had not yet decided what to do. No Southern governor, except William Gist of South Carolina, seemed willing to lead the South out of the Union.
Abraham Lincoln was elected president on November 6, 1860. South Carolina exploded with excitement at the news. To many of the people there, Lincoln's victory was a signal that ended the state's ties to the Union. To them, it was the beginning of Southern independence. Both United States senators from South Carolina resigned. So did a federal judge and the collector of federal taxes. United States flags were lowered. State flags were raised in their place. The state legislature agreed to open a convention on December 17th. The convention would make the final decision on leaving the Union. Several other Southern states did the same.
This idea of leaving the Union, secession, split North and South just as much as slavery. Southerners claimed they had the right to secede peacefully. Northerners disagreed. They said secession was treason. They said it would lead to civil war. In the months before Lincoln's inauguration, President James Buchanan tried to deal with the situation. First, he proposed a convention of all the states. The purpose of the convention would be to work out differences between North and South. The Southern members of Buchanan's cabinet rejected this idea. The second proposal was a strong policy statement on secession. The statement would include an opinion by the Attorney General. It said the government could use force, if necessary, to keep states in the Union. The Southern cabinet members rejected this idea, too.
President Buchanan had to settle for a moderate policy statement on secession. It said the president could send troops into a state to help federal marshals enforce the rulings of federal courts. But if federal judges resigned, there would be no federal court rulings to enforce. Therefore, to send troops to a state where federal officers had resigned, such as South Carolina, would be an act of war against the state, and only Congress had the constitutional power to declare war. Buchanan accepted this statement. He was only too happy to let Congress decide what to do.
There was little chance that Congress could do anything. Congressmen from both North and South already had made decisions that could not and would not be changed easily. Most of the congressmen from states in the Deep South supported secession. They did not want to remain in the Union. Many congressmen from states in the North had been elected because they promised to keep slavery from spreading to the Western territories. They did not plan to break their promises. A few lawmakers hoped President Buchanan, in his yearly message to Congress, might propose a compromise.
Buchanan began by denouncing Northern abolitionists. He said they were responsible for the present problem. Their interference, he said, had created a great fear of slave rebellions in the South. Then Buchanan called on the South to accept the election of Abraham Lincoln. He said the election of a citizen to the office of president should not be a reason for dissolving the Union. Buchanan declared that the Constitution gave no state the right to leave. But, he admitted, if a state did secede, there was little the federal government could do. The fact is, Buchanan said, that our Union rests upon public opinion. It can never be held together by the blood of its citizens in civil war. If it cannot live in the hearts of its people, then it must one day die.
Buchanan proposed to Congress that it offer a constitutional amendment on the question of slavery. He said the amendment should recognize the right to own slaves as property in states where slavery was permitted. It should protect this right in all territories until the territories became states. And it should end all state laws that interfered with the return of escaped slaves to their owners. No one liked President Buchanan's message to Congress. Northerners did not like his declaration of federal weakness in the face of secession. Southerners did not like his declaration that secession was unconstitutional. The message did nothing to change the situation. Soon after it was read to Congress, South Carolina opened its secession convention.
Delegates to the convention would make the final decision if South Carolina would remain in the Union or secede. There was little question how they would vote. A committee wrote a secession resolution. The resolution said simply that the people of South Carolina were ending the agreement of 1788, in which the state had approved the Constitution of the United States. It said the Union, existing between South Carolina and the United States of America, was being dissolved. The committee offered the resolution to the convention on December 20th, 1860. There was no debate. The delegates voted immediately. No one voted against it.
South Carolina had seceded. But what must it do now? There was the problem of property in South Carolina owned by the federal government. The convention continued to meet to work out details of South Carolina's new position in the world.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.